unchecked, destroy the very things that it aimed to buy and sell. The commodity fiction disregarded the fact that leaving the fate of soil and people to the market would be tantamount to annihilating them. In the absence of synthetic declaration, Polanyi's prophecy appears headed for fulfillment, and this fact alone must put us on alert. What does Polanyi's prophecy augur for our time? Industrial capitalism followed its own logic of shock and awe, taking aim at nature to conquer it in the interests of capital. Now surveillance capitalism has human nature in its sights. We have only gradually come to understand that the specific methods of domination employed by industrial capitalism for more than two centuries have fundamentally disoriented the conditions that support life on Earth, violating the most basic precepts of civilization. Despite the many benefits and immense accomplishments of industrial capitalism, it has left us perilously close to repeating the fate of the Easter Islanders, who wrecked the ground that gave them life, then fashioned statues to scan the horizon for the aid and succor that would never come. If industrial capitalism dangerously disrupted nature, what havoc might surveillance capitalism wreak on human nature? The answer to this question requires a return to imperatives. Industrial capitalism brought us to the brink of epic peril, but not as a consequence of an evil lust for destruction or runaway technology. Rather, this result was ineluctably driven by its own inner logic of accumulation, with its imperatives of profit maximization, competition, the relentless drive for labor productivity through the technological elaboration of production, and growth funded by the continuous reinvestment of surplus. It is Weber's economic orientation that matters, and how that orientation merges with the specific form of capitalism that rises to dominance in each age. The logic of industrial capitalism exempted the enterprise from responsibility for its destructive consequences, unleashing the destabilization of the climate system and the chaos it spells for all creatures. Polanyi understood that raw capitalism could not be cooked from within. He argued that it was up to society to impose those obligations on capitalism by insisting on measures that tether the capitalist project to the social, preserving and sustaining life and nature. Similarly, the meaning of Polanyi's prophecy for us now can be grasped only through the lens of surveillance capitalism's economic imperatives as they frame its claim to human experience. If we are to rediscover our sense of astonishment, then let it be here. If industrial civilization flourished at the expense of nature and now threatens to cost us the earth, an information civilization shaped by surveillance capitalism will thrive at the expense of human nature and threatens to cost us our humanity. Polanyi's prophecy requires us to ask if we may yet avert this fate with our own synthetic declarations. Parts 1 and 2 have been devoted to understanding the origins of surveillance capitalism and identifying, naming, and scrutinizing its foundational mechanisms and economic imperatives. The idea from the start was that naming and taming are inextricable, that fresh and careful naming can better equip us to intercept these mechanisms of dispossession, reverse their action, produce urgently needed friction, challenge the pathological division of learning, and ultimately synthesize new forms of information capitalism that genuinely meet our needs for effective life. Social participation and individual effectiveness should not require the sacrifice of our right to the future tense, which comprises our will to will, our autonomy, our decision rights, our privacy, and indeed our human natures. However, it would be wrong to suppose that surveillance capitalism can be grasped solely through the prism of its economic action, or that the challenges we face are restricted to discerning, containing, and transforming its foundational mechanisms. The consequences of this new logic of accumulation have already leaked and continue to leak beyond commercial practices into the fabric of our social relations, transforming our relationships to ourselves and to one another. These transformations provide the soil in which surveillance capitalism has flourished, an invasive species that creates its own food supply. In transforming us, it produces nourishment for its own march forward. It is easier, perhaps, to see these dynamics by looking to the past. The difference between industrial capitalism and industrial civilization is the difference between the economic operation and the societies it produced. The variant of industrial capitalism that rose to dominance in the late 19th and early 20th centuries produced a specific kind of moral milieu that we sense intuitively, even when we do not name it. Industrial capitalism was marked by the specialized division of labor, with its historically specific characteristics. The conversion of craft work to mass production, based on standardization, rationalization, and the interchangeability of parts. The moving assembly line, volume production, large populations of wage earners concentrated in factory settings, professionalized administrative hierarchies, managerial authority, functional specialization, and the distinction between white-collar work and blue-collar work. The list is illustrative, not exhaustive, but enough to remind us that industrial civilization was drawn from these expressions of the economic imperatives that ruled industrial expansion. The division of labor shaped culture, psychology, and social experience. The shift from craft to hourly wages created new populations of employees and consumers, men and women wholly dependent on the means of production owned and operated by private firms. This was the crucible of mass society, its hierarchical authority, and its centralized bureaucratic forms of public and private power, all of it haunted by the specters of conformity, obedience, and human standardization. Lives were defined by institutions that mirrored industrial organization, schools, hospitals, and even aspects of family and domestic life, in which ages and stages were understood as functions in the industrial system, from training to retirement. At a time when surveillance capitalism has emerged as the dominant form of information capitalism, we must ask the question, what kind of civilization does it foretell? The chapters that follow in Part 3 are intended as an initial contribution to this urgent conversation. I have said that there can be no commitment to guaranteed outcomes without the power to make it so. What is the nature of this new power? How will it transform our societies? What solution for a third modernity does it proffer? What novel struggles will haunt these new days, and what do they portend for a digital future that we can call home? These are the questions that guide us into Part 3. Part 3. Instrumentarian Power for a Third Modernity. Chapter 12. Two Species of Power. So an age ended, and its last deliverer died, in bed, grown idle and unhappy, they were safe. The sudden shadow of a giant's enormous calf would fall no more at dusk across their lawns outside. W. H. Auden, Sonnets from China, 10. 1. A Return to the Unprecedented. Under surveillance capitalism, the means of production serves the means of behavioral modification. Machine processes replace human relationships so that certainty can replace trust. This new assembly relies on a vast digital apparatus, world historic concentrations of advanced computational knowledge and skill, and immense wealth. The arc of behavioral modification at scale integrates the many operations that we have examined: ubiquitous extraction and rendition, actuation, tuning, herding, conditioning, behavioral surplus supply chains, machine intelligence-based manufacturing processes, fabrication of prediction products, dynamic behavioral futures markets, and targeting, which leads to fresh rounds of tuning, herding, conditioning, and the coercions of the uncontract, thus renewing the cycle. This assembly is a market project. Its purpose is to fabricate predictions, which become more valuable as they approach certainty. The best predictions feed on totalities of data, and on the strength of this movement toward totality, surveillance capitalists have hijacked the division of learning in society. They command knowledge from the decisive pinnacle of the social order, where they nourish and protect the shadow text, the urtext of certainty. This is the market net in which we are snared. In parts 1 and 2, we examined the conditions, mechanisms, and operations that construct this private knowledge kingdom and its lucrative predictions that evolve toward certainty in order to guarantee market players the outcomes that they seek. As I wrote in Chapter 7, there can be no guarantee of outcomes without the power to make it so. This is the dark heart of surveillance capitalism, a new type of commerce that reimagines us through the lens of its own distinctive power, mediated by its means of behavioral modification. What is this power, and how does it remake human nature for the sake of its lucrative certainties? As to this species of power, I name it instrumentarianism, defined as the instrumentation and instrumentalization of behavior for the purposes of modification, prediction, monetization, and control. In this formulation, instrumentation refers to the puppet, the ubiquitous connected material architecture of sensate computation that renders, interprets, and actuates human experience. Instrumentalization denotes the social relations that orient the puppet masters to human experience, as surveillance capital wields the machines to transform us into means to others' market ends. Surveillance capitalism forced us to reckon with an unprecedented form of capitalism. Now the instrumentarian power that sustains and enlarges the surveillance capitalist project compels a second confrontation with the unprecedented. When scholars, civil society leaders, journalists, public figures, and indeed most of us speak out courageously against this new power, invariably we look to Orwell's Big Brother, and more generally the specter of totalitarianism as the lens through which to interpret today's threats. Google, Facebook, and the larger field of commercial surveillance are frequently depicted as digital totalitarianism. I admire those who have stood against the incursions of commercial surveillance, but I also suggest that the equation of instrumentarian power with totalitarianism impedes our understanding, as well as our ability to resist, neutralize, and ultimately vanquish its potency. There is no historical precedent for instrumentarianism, but there is vivid precedent for this kind of encounter with an unprecedented new species of power. In the years before totalitarianism was named and formally analyzed, its critics appropriated the language of imperialism as the only framework at hand with which to articulate and resist the new power's murderous threats. Now, surveillance capitalism has cast us adrift in another odd, dark sea of novel and thus indiscernible dangers. As scholars and citizens did before us, it is we who now reach for familiar vernaculars of 20th century power like life-saving driftwood. We are back to the syndrome of the horseless carriage, where we attach our new sense of peril to old, familiar facts, unaware that the conclusions to which they lead us are necessarily incorrect. Instead, we need to grasp the specific inner logic of a conspicuously 21st century conjuring of power for which the past offers no adequate compass. Totalitarianism was bent on the reconstruction of the human species through the dual mechanisms of genocide and the engineering of the soul. Instrumentarian power, as we shall see, takes us in a sharply different direction. Surveillance capitalists have no interest in murder or the reformation of our souls, although their aims are in many ways just as ambitious as those of totalitarian leaders, they are also utterly distinct. The work of naming a strange form of power, unprecedented in the human experience, must begin anew for the sake of effective resistance and the creative power to insist on a future of our own making. The remainder of this chapter prepares the way. The first task is to develop our understanding of what instrumentarian power is not. So in the section that follows, we briefly consider key elements of 20th century totalitarianism. Most important is the fact that, like instrumentarianism, totalitarian power was also unprecedented. It literally defied human comprehension. There is much that we can learn from the struggles and missteps of scholars, journalists, and citizens as they found themselves overwhelmed by a force that they could neither fathom nor resist. Once we have tackled these questions, we will be equipped to bear down on an exploration of instrumentarianism's origins in a field of intellectual endeavor that came to be known as radical behaviorism, most notably championed by B.F. Skinner and his dream of a technology of behavior. In Chapter 13, we integrate our insights to consider the unique aims and strategies of instrumentarian power. 2. Totalitarianism as a new species of power. The word totalitarianism first appeared in the early 20th century work of Italian philosopher Giovanni Gentile and came into wider use later with Mussolini's The Doctrine of Fascism, co-written in 1932 with Gentile, who was by then Italy's premier philosopher of fascism. Italy had entered the 20th century as a second-rate country, ignored on the world stage, nursing a sense of failure and humiliation, and unable to support its own population as millions emigrated in search of a better life. In the first decade of the 20th century, a new generation of intellectuals and avant-garde futurists began to weave the dream of a new Italy. Gentile dedicated his philosophical talents to the revival of nationalist zeal. At the heart of Gentile's political philosophy is the concept of the total. The state was to be understood as an inclusive organic unity that transcends individual lives. All separateness and difference are surrendered to the state for the sake of this superordinate totality. In 1932, Mussolini charged Gentile with writing the philosophical introduction to his book, while Mussolini authored the social and political principles that would define the fascist worldview. The doctrine begins by declaring the fascist attitude as, above all, a spiritual attitude that penetrates the most intimate redoubt of each human participant. To know men, one must know man. Fascism is totalitarian, and the fascist state, a synthesis and a unit inclusive of all values, interprets, develops, and potentates the whole life of a people. It is an inwardly accepted standard and rule of conduct, a discipline of the whole person. It permeates the will no less than the intellect, sinking deep down into his personality. It dwells in the heart of the man of action and of the thinker, of the artist, and of the man of science. Soul of the soul, it aims at refashioning not only the forms of life, but their content. Man, his character, and his faith, entering into the soul and ruling with undisputed sway. That year, the refashioning of the soul as the hallmark of the totalitarian impulse was immortalized by Stalin on a glittering, champagne-soaked Moscow evening. The setting was an auspicious literary gathering hosted by a compliant Maxim Gorky in the sprawling mansion that Stalin had presented to the revered author upon his return to Russia from a self-imposed Italian exile. Stalin took the floor for a toast as the room fell silent. "Our tanks are worthless if the souls who must steer them are made of clay. This is why I say the production of souls is more important than that of tanks. Man is reshaped by life itself, and those of you here must assist in reshaping his soul. That is what is important, the production of human souls, and that is why I raise my glass to you, writers, to the engineers of the soul." The authors assembled around Stalin that evening raised their glasses to his toast, persuaded perhaps by memories of less adaptive colleagues already exiled or executed, including the 1929 torture and murder of artists and writers in the Solovetsky Islands aptly named Church of the Beheading. By 1933, the term totalitarianism had begun to circulate widely in Germany. Minister of Propaganda Joseph Goebbels adopted it, and German intellectuals declared the turn to totalitarianism. Nazism also shifted the doctrine in an important way, asserting the movement, not the state, as the spiritual center of German totalitarianism, a relationship summarized during Hitler's first years as chancellor in National Socialism's popular slogan, "The movement gives orders to the state." That totalitarianism was a new species of power had confounded its analysis from the start, as both its Russian and German variants swept through those societies, challenging the foundations of Western civilization. Although these totalitarian regimes began to take root years before World War II, first in Russia in 1929 with Stalin's ascension to power, and then in Germany in 1933 with Hitler's installation as chancellor, they eluded systematic study until the end of the war. Analysis was impeded in part by the sheer mystery and perpetual movement of the whole enterprise, the secret plans executed by secret police, the silent complicities and hidden atrocities, the ceaseless transformation of who or what was up or down, the intentional torsion of facts into anti-facts, accompanied by a perpetual deluge of propaganda, misinformation, euphemism, and mendacity. The authoritative leader, or egocrat, to use the French philosopher Claude Lefort's term, displaces the rule of law and common sense to become the quixotic judge of what is just or unjust, truth or lie at each moment. Western publics, especially in the U.S., were genuinely unable to grasp the enormity of what was underway. It literally boggled minds. This intellectual paralysis is immortalized in the pages of a cultural icon of that era, Look magazine. Its August 15, 1939 issue featured an article titled, "What's Going On in Russia?" written by New York Times former Moscow bureau chief and Pulitzer Prize winner Walter Duranty. The piece appeared just months after the conclusion of the Great Terror, when, between 1937 and 1938, Stalin ordered the murders of whole sectors of the Soviet population, from poets to diplomats, generals to political loyalists. According to Soviet historian Robert Conquest, that two-year period saw 7 million arrests, 1 million executions, 2 million deaths in labor camps, 1 million people imprisoned, and another 7 million people still in camps by the end of 1938. Despite the immediacy of catastrophic evil, Duranty's article describes the constitution of the USSR as one of the most democratic in the world, a foundation on which a future democracy may be built. In addition to praiseworthy descriptions of the Red Army, free education and medical care, communal housing, and equality of the sexes, there is an upbeat commentary in which the Great Purge is breezily described as one of the periodic cleansings of the Communist Party. Duranty reports that this cleansing is now over and people are repairing the damage, as if the country were tidying up after a particularly nasty winter storm. In fact, the Stalinist pattern of violence, imprisonment, exile, and execution merely shifted its focus with a swift and terrifying ferocity to the Baltic and eastern Poland. Among the many atrocities between 1939 and 1941, hundreds of thousands of Poles were marched to northern labor camps, and tens of thousands of members of the Polish Communist Party were murdered. Just 1 week after Duranty's article, Stalin signed a non-aggression pact with Hitler, attacked Poland in September, and in November the Red Army invaded Finland. In 1940, Stalin ordered the massacre of 15,000 Polish nationalists taken as prisoners of war in the 1939 attack. The most startling feature of Duranty's essay is its characterization of Stalin himself. There, sandwiched between a celebratory feature on a newly released film called The Wizard of Oz, and a lengthy spread on embarrassing celebrity pictures, such as the famed ventriloquist's dummy, Charlie McCarthy, with a cigarette in his wooden mouth, is a photo of a handsome, smiling Joseph Stalin captioned, "Stalin, chairman of the inner circle of the Communist Party, does not lay down the law as Lenin did. Stalin prefers to hear the views of his associates before he makes his own decision." Stalin's 1939 lionization in Look as an exemplar of participatory management was followed a few months later with his ascension to Time magazine's cover as Man of the Year. Indeed, between 1930 and his death in 1953, Stalin made a total of 10 appearances on the cover of Time. All of this provides some sense of totalitarianism's elaboration and institutionalization long before it was identified and analyzed as a coherent new form of power that, as many scholars would conclude, posed history's greatest threat to civilization. With a few important exceptions, it was only after the Nazi defeat that the program of naming began in earnest. "Plenty of information was available contradicting the official picture," writes Conquest. He asks why journalists, sociologists, and other visitors were taken in by the Soviet regime's lies. One reason is that the Soviet government went to a great deal of trouble to present a false picture, including model prisons that betrayed no trace of the immense state machinery of torture and death. Another reason was the credulity of the observers themselves. In some cases, like Durante's, they were blinded by an ideological allegiance to the idea of a socialist state. The most compelling reason of all is that in most of these cases, journalists, scholars, and Western governments had a difficult time reckoning the full weight of totalitarianism's monstrous achievements because the actual facts were so improbable that it was difficult even for specialists to grasp their truth. "The Stalin epic," writes Conquest, "is replete with what appear as improbabilities to minds unfitted to deal with the phenomena." This failure of comprehension has immediate significance for us as we learn to reckon with surveillance capitalism and its new instrumentarian power. The confrontation with totalitarianism's impossibility is reflected in the moving accounts of the first scholars determined to lift the veil on that era's gruesome truths. Nearly every intellectual who turned to this project in the period immediately following the war cites the feeling of astonishment at the suddenness with which, as Harvard political scientist Carl Friedrich put it, totalitarianism had burst upon mankind, unexpected and unannounced. Its manifestations were so novel and unanticipated, so shocking, rapid, and unparalleled, that all of it eluded language, challenging every tradition, norm, value, and legitimate form of action. The systemic accretion of violence and complicity that engulfed whole populations at extreme velocity invoked a kind of bewilderment that ended in paralysis, even for many of the greatest minds of the 20th century. Friedrich was among the first scholars of totalitarianism to address this experience of improbability, writing in 1954 that "virtually no one before 1914 anticipated the course of development which has overtaken Western civilization since then. None of the outstanding scholars in history, law, and the social sciences discerned what was ahead, which culminated in totalitarianism." To this failure to foresee corresponds a difficulty in comprehending. Not even the most far-sighted of the early-century interpreters of industrial society, thinkers such as Durkheim and Weber, had anticipated this murderous turn. Hannah Arendt described the defeat of Nazi Germany as the first chance to try to tell and to understand what had happened, still in grief and sorrow and a tendency to lament, but no longer in speechless outrage and impotent horror. Ultimately, a courageous and brilliant body of scholarship would evolve to meet the challenge of comprehension. It yielded different models and schools of thought, each with distinct emphasis and insights. But these shared common purpose in finally naming the great evil. Totalitarianism has discovered a means of dominating and terrorizing human beings from within, wrote Arendt, the German-born philosopher who would spend the 6 years after World War II writing her extraordinary study of totalitarian power, published in 1951 as The Origins of Totalitarianism. Arendt's was a detailed disclosure and a pioneering attempt to theorize what had just occurred. Comprehension, she said, is the necessary response to the truly radical nature of evil disclosed by totalitarianism. It means examining and bearing consciously the burden which our century has placed on us, neither denying its existence nor submitting meekly to its weight. Totalitarianism was bent on the destruction of humanity and the essence of man, and, she insisted, to turn our backs on the destructive forces of the century is of little avail. Essential to totalitarianism was the deletion of all ties and sources of meaning other than the movement. Total loyalty, the psychological basis for domination, can be expected only from the completely isolated human being who, without any other social ties to family, friends, comrades, or even mere acquaintances, derives his sense of having a place in the world only from his belonging to a movement, his membership in the party. Mid-century scholars such as Friedrich, Adorno, Gourian, Brzezinski, and Aron added to these themes, recognizing totalitarianism's insistence on domination of the human soul. To command populations right down to their souls requires unimaginable effort, which was one reason why totalitarianism was unimaginable. It requires henchmen, and their henchmen, and their henchmen, all willing to roll up both sleeves and thrust both hands into the blood and shit of actual living persons whose bodies stink and sweat and cry out in terror, grief, and pain. It measures success at the cellular level, penetrating to the quick where it subverts and commands each unspoken yearning in pursuit of the genocidal vision that historian Richard Shorten calls the experiment in reshaping humanity. The destruction and reconstruction of society and the purification of the human species were prosecuted in the name of class in Stalin's Soviet Union and race in Hitler's Germany. Each regime invented outgroups slated for murder. The Jewish people, Romanis, homosexuals, and revolutionaries in Germany and Eastern Europe, whole segments of the population in Stalin's Russia, and in-groups required to submit body and soul to the regime. In this way, totalitarian regimes could achieve their fantastical aim of the people as one, as Claude Lefort describes it. Social unanimity corresponds to inner unanimity, held in place by hatred activated toward the enemies of the people. Totalitarian power cannot succeed by remote control. Mere conformity is insufficient. Each individual inner life must be claimed and transformed by the perpetual threat of punishment without crime. Mass murder warrants economies of scale. The camps, massacres, and gulags. But for the rest, it would be a handmade terror that aims to remake every aspect of the individual from the inside out. Heart, mind, sexuality, personality, and spirit. This craftwork requires the detailed orchestration of isolation, anxiety, fear, persuasion, fantasy, longing, inspiration, torture, dread, and surveillance. Arendt describes the relentless process of atomization and fusion in which terror destroys the ordinary human bonds of law, norms, trust, and affection, which provide the living space for the freedom of the individual. The iron band of terror mercilessly presses men against each other so that the very space of free action disappears. Terror fabricates the oneness of all men. 3. An opposite horizon. Instrumentarian power moves differently and toward an opposite horizon. Totalitarianism operated through the means of violence, But instrumentarian power operates through the means of behavioral modification, and this is where our focus must shift. Instrumentarian power has no interest in our souls or any principle to instruct. There is no training or transformation for spiritual salvation, no ideology against which to judge our actions. It does not demand possession of each person from the inside out. It has no interest in exterminating or disfiguring our bodies and minds in the name of pure devotion. It welcomes data on the behavior of our blood and shit, but it has no interest in soiling itself with our excretions. It has no appetite for our grief, pain, or terror, although it eagerly welcomes the behavioral surplus that leeches from our anguish. It is profoundly and infinitely indifferent to our meanings and motives. Trained on measurable action, it only cares that whatever we do is accessible to its ever-evolving operations of rendition, calculation, modification, monetization, and control. Although it is not murderous, instrumentarianism is as startling, incomprehensible, and new to the human story as totalitarianism was to its witnesses and victims. Our encounter with unprecedented power helps to explain why it has been difficult to name and know this new species of coercion, shaped in secret, camouflaged by technology and technical complexity, and obfuscated by endearing rhetoric. Totalitarianism was a political project that converged with economics to overwhelm society. Instrumentarianism is a market project that converges with the digital to achieve its own unique brand of social domination. It is not surprising, therefore, that instrumentarianism's specific viewpoint of observation was forged in the controversial intellectual domain known as radical behaviorism and its antecedents in turn-of-the-century theoretical physics. In the remainder of this chapter, our examination of power in the time of surveillance capitalism pivots to this point of origin, far from totalitarianism's murder and mayhem. It takes us to laboratories and classrooms and the realms of thought spun by men who regarded freedom as a synonym for ignorance and human beings as distant organisms imprisoned in patterns of behavior beyond their own comprehension or control, such as ants, bees, or Stuart McKay's herds of elk. 4. The Other One. In a 1971 cover story, Time magazine described Burris Frederick, B.F. Skinner, as an institution at Harvard, the most influential of living American psychologists, and the most controversial contemporary figure in the science of human behavior, adored as a messiah and abhorred as a menace. Skinner spent most of his career in the psychology department at Harvard University, and some of my most vivid memories of graduate school are the times I spent with him in close debate. I admit that those conversations did little to alter our respective views, but they left me with an indelible sense of fascination, with a way of construing human life that was, and is, fundamentally different from my own. As an academic psychologist, Skinner was famous for the ingenious tools and techniques he invented to study animal behavior, first in the ancient, murky basement of Memorial Hall, and later on the seventh floor of the newly constructed William James Hall, as well as the insights that he and his students developed into the shaping of that behavior. Pigeons and levers, pigeons and pellets, pigeons on hot plates, rats in mazes. His early research broke new ground as he engineered variable schedules of reinforcement to produce detailed patterns of activity that were foreign to an animal's original behavioral repertoire, work that he called operant conditioning. Inspired by his effort during World War II to transform a flock of pigeons into the conditioned intelligence for guided missiles, one that did not ultimately come to fruition, Skinner set out on a new path defined by the promise of behavioral engineering. In 1947, he told a symposium, "It is not a matter of bringing the world into the laboratory, but of extending the practices of an experimental science to the world at large. We can do this as soon as we wish to do it." The missile project had cast the meaning of his experimental work in a new light. He reflected years later in his autobiography. It was no longer merely an experimental analysis. It had given rise to a technology. Skinner was eager to apply his laboratory insights to the world's ills, despite precious few grounds for his inferential leaps. As a public intellectual, he spent nearly 7 decades trying to persuade the public that his radical behaviorism offered the principles of social organization necessary to defend civilization from cataclysm. He brashly extrapolated from the conduct of beleaguered animals to grand theories of social behavior and human evolution in books such as his 1948 utopian novel, Walden 2, and his 1971 social philosophy, Beyond Freedom and Dignity. In 1974, Skinner published About Behaviorism, another explanation of the radical behaviorist project, this time addressed to a general readership. It aimed to counter the opposition to his views that had grown even more virulent since the unusual, and to many repugnant, arguments advanced in Beyond Freedom and Dignity. He regarded such opposition as the result of an extraordinary misunderstanding, and he was tireless in his efforts to reverse public opinion. He believed that once people correctly understood his meaning, they would certainly agree with his message. In the very first pages of About Behaviorism, Skinner ignores the outrage generated by Beyond Freedom and Dignity, instead delving into behaviorism's roots and its earliest theorists and practitioners. He places much of the blame for the antipathy toward behaviorism on the man who is widely regarded as its founder, John B. Watson. It was Watson who famously announced in 1913 the behaviorist point of view. Psychology, as the behaviorist views it, is a purely objective experimental branch of natural science. Its theoretical goal is the prediction and control of behavior. Introspection forms no essential part of its methods. The behaviorist recognizes no dividing line between man and brute. But Watson turned out to be as much showman as scientist, and Skinner bitterly criticizes his extreme claims and shortage of facts that cast lasting doubt on radical behaviorism. Having identified Watson as the main author of the problem, Skinner then credits the work of Max Meyer, an obscure early 20th century German-trained experimental psychologist who spent most of his career at the University of Missouri, as key to the solution. Meyer had pursued his doctoral studies at the University of Berlin, where his dissertation advisor, Max Planck, was destined to become one of the most celebrated physicists of all time. Planck insisted on the unity of the physical world and the discoverability of the natural laws that would disclose their secrets only through mathematical analysis, including the laws of human behavior. The outside world is something independent from man, something absolute, Planck wrote. The quest for the laws which apply to this absolute appeared as the most sublime scientific pursuit in life. Meyer carried Planck's teaching into his quest for the principles that would finally elevate the study of human behavior to true scientific status. According to Skinner, Meyer succeeded in achieving the breakthrough that finally allowed psychology to assume its rightful place alongside the disciplines of physics, chemistry, and biology. Why did Skinner extol this work that had been largely ignored even in his own time? Skinner singles out for special praise a 1921 textbook that bore the ominous-sounding title Psychology of the Other One. It received scant attention when it was published. Meyer had written it primarily for his own students, and had since fallen into total obscurity. Nonetheless, Skinner praised the book for establishing the epistemological and methodological foundations of modern behaviorism. Consider only those facts which can be objectively observed in the behavior of one person in its relation to his prior environmental history. In Skinner's formulation, Meyer's book was a turning point, bravely combining psychology and physics in the quest for absolutes. It asserted the essence of the behaviorist's point of view, where the world within the skin of the other one loses its preferred status. The phrase that captured a new scientific perspective was the other one. Human behavior would yield to scientific research only if psychologists learned to view humans as others. This viewpoint of observation was an absolute requirement for an objective science of human behavior that ceased to confuse inner experience with external action. Central to this new viewpoint was his notion of the human being as organism. The human being is recast as an it, an other, a they of organisms, and organism among organisms, distinguishable from a lettuce, a moose, or an inchworm, only in degree of complexity. A scientific psychology would restrict its interests to the social, and therefore visible behaviors of this organism as an organism. It would be the study of the life of the other one, but of his life insofar as it is of social significance, rather than as it is of significance for himself. We are studying the other one in preference to ourselves. The logical consequences of the new viewpoint necessitated a reinterpretation of the higher-order human experiences that we call freedom and will. Meyer echoed Planck in positing that freedom of action in the animal world signifies the same that is meant by accidents in the world of physics. Such accidents are simply phenomena for which there are insufficient information and understanding. And so it goes with freedom. The liberal idea of freedom persists in an inverse relationship to the growth of scientific knowledge, especially in the field of psychological science. Knowledge and freedom are necessarily adversaries. As Meyer wrote, "The other one's conduct is free, uncaused, only in the same sense in which the issue of a disease, the outcome of a war, the weather, the crops are free and uncaused." That is, in the sense of general human ignorance of the particular causes of the particular outcome. Decades later, this worldview would define the core of the controversial social philosophy espoused in Beyond Freedom and Dignity, in which Skinner argues that knowledge does not make us free, but rather releases us from the illusion of freedom. In reality, he writes, freedom and ignorance are synonyms. The acquisition of knowledge is heroic in that it rescues us from ignorance, but it is also tragic because it necessarily reveals the impossibility of freedom. For Meyer and for Skinner, our attachments to notions such as freedom, will, autonomy, purpose, and agency are defense mechanisms that protect us from the uncomfortable facts of human ignorance. I think of Dickens' Scrooge when he first encounters the doleful, chain-dragging ghost of his deceased partner Jacob Marley and denies the apparition, saying, "You may be an undigested bit of beef, a blot of mustard, a crumb of cheese, a fragment of an underdone potato." So it is with freedom, an undigested bit of fear, a crumb of denial that, once metabolized, will dispel the apparition and deliver us to reality. The environment determines behavior, and our ignorance of precisely how it does so is the void that we fill with the fantasy of freedom. Meyer took great pains to insist that the significance of human inwardness, soul, self, mind, consciousness, is restricted to the subjective life of the individual. It can have no scientific value because it cannot be observed and measured. We do not deny the soul, but we do not devote our time to it. We find enough, and more than enough, to do studying the body. The soul is your own business, an intimate experience and irreducible mystery that are formally exempt from scientific inquiry. Human societies can thus be understood as originating from natural laws, not in the sense of groups of souls, though, but in the sense of groups of organisms. Meyer argued that the future of the social sciences and of civilization itself rested on this shift from soul to other, inside to outside, lived experience to observable behavior. The otherization of humanity was to be the road to a new kind of political liberation. History's grim cavalcade of repression, torture, massacre, enslavement, and genocide had been prosecuted in the name of the domination of the human soul for the sake of religious or political power. From Meyer's vantage point in the Missouri of 1921, during those years after the Great War, his solution for an efficient and rational modernity must have felt like a matter of life and death. He whose interest is centered in souls thinks, when he has forced others to speak his prayer, pronounce his creed, kneel before his altar, that he has saved their souls, and fails to admit that he has merely forced their bodies. Political terrorism, too, has its main and inexhaustible source in the human tendency to think of other beings not as bodies open to scientific investigation, but as souls, as mysterious beings to be governed either by magic, or if magic fails, as it naturally must, by torture and death. Recall the horrors of the torture of such courts as the Spanish Inquisition, or the witchcraft courts of the 17th century. These atrocities were due to the fact that the judge was serving as a mind reader, and that the accused was regarded primarily as a soul. In Meyer's thinking, the shift in perspective from the human being as a soul to the human being as an organism explained why the trend of history is in the direction of democracy. As science overtakes civilization, Meyer assumed a new global recognition of equality and democratic fellowship rooted in the basic fact of our overwhelming similarity as fellow organisms. The divisions that haunt society, politics, and economics based on class, wealth, liberality, race, and so on would become ridiculous. In real worldwide human life, the differences among individuals are entirely swamped by their likenesses. To him who accepts the scientific view that human society is a group of organisms, it is an absurd proposition to divide into classes. Meyer believed that every social science that aspired to true scientific status would embrace the viewpoint of the other one. Psychology, of course, but also sociology, economics, criminology, history, and the psychology of religion. Christ going among his fellow men, an organism among organisms. Otherizing would pave the way to a rational future, with its bleak satisfactions that resign humanity to the forfeit of freedom as the price of knowledge. 5. Against Freedom. Skinner's commitment to the viewpoint of the other one was unshakable, and it is through his elaboration of this viewpoint that we can begin to grasp the essence of instrumentarian power. From the opening page of Skinner's first book, The Behavior of Organisms, published in 1938, he sounds Myers and Planck's caution. Freedom is merely ignorance waiting to be conquered. Primitive systems of behavior assign causality to entities beyond man. Equally inadequate are the advanced systems of behavior that ascribe control to vague fictions such as the self or free will. The inner organism, he wrote, may in resignation be called free, as in the case of free will, when no further investigation is held to be possible. Skinner called his work radical behaviorism, insisting that the only meaningful object of behavioral study was observation of action devoid of subjective attributions. That's what made it radical. Behavior is what an organism is doing, or more accurately, what it is observed by another organism to be doing, he declared in his first book's opening pages. Operant behavior was his term for this active, observable doing. The vocabulary for rendering descriptions of operant behavior was to be purged of inwardness. An organism cannot be said to see, but rather to look toward. Only such objective descriptions can render measurable behavioral facts that, in turn, lead to patterns and ultimately to the documentation of causal relationships between environment and behavior. Skinner published Science and Human Behavior in 1951, positing that all observation, even one's own behavior, must be enacted from the viewpoint of the other one. This discipline makes it possible to take almost anything as an object of behavioral analysis, including inferred behaviors such as making choices or problem solving, the very perspective that would later be amply exploited by the new discipline of behavioral economics. When a man controls himself, chooses a course of action, thinks out the solution to a problem, or strives toward an increase in self-knowledge, he is behaving. He controls himself precisely as he would control the behavior of anyone else, through the manipulation of variables of which behavior is a function. His behavior in so doing is a proper object of analysis, and eventually it must be accounted for with variables lying outside the individual himself. In nearly every book and article, Skinner declared the truth that Planck taught Meyer and Meyer imparted to his students, the single truth that can be grasped only through the viewpoint of the other one. Freedom is ignorance. The felt experience of free will is but a bit of undigested denial, produced by a lack of information about the actual determinants of behavior. Like Meyer and Planck before him, Skinner regarded freedom as an accident, arguing that the very notion of accident is illusory, a snapshot in time that reveals a lacuna waiting to be filled and eventually transformed by advancing knowledge into an expression of a lawful, predictable pattern. Under the behaviorist's gaze, these lacunae of ignorance that we mistake for free will are queuing up for explanation, rather like someone who consigns his or her body to cryonic preservation in the hope of some future awakening and cure. In the most audacious of Skinner's literary efforts, the extended philosophical essay published in 1971 as Beyond Freedom and Dignity, he repeats, "There is no virtue in the accidental nature of an accident." That entire work was trained on what Skinner continued to regard as the chief impediment to social progress, the conceptual confusion that cloaks our deepest ignorance in the sacred robes of freedom and dignity. Skinner argued that our allegiance to these lofty notions is simply the way we protect ourselves from the hard truths of unsuspected controlling relations between behavior and environment. They are a psychological escape route that slowly closes as new evidence of the predictability of human behavior are discovered. Personal exemption from a complete determinism is revoked as a scientific analysis progresses. The achievements for which a person himself is to be given credit seem to approach zero. The behavior we admire is therefore the behavior we cannot yet explain. Richard Herrnstein, one of Skinner's most accomplished students, later his colleague in Harvard's psychology department, and a luminary of radical behaviorism, once explained to me that any action regarded as an expression of free will is simply one for which the vortex of stimuli that produced it cannot yet be adequately specified. We merely lack the means of observation and calculation. I was a 23-year-old student, and the term was new and startling to me. I never forgot that conversation, perhaps because it came as close as any to summarizing the behaviorist's conception of God. Indeed, there was a time when if you took the elevator to Skinner's lab on the 7th floor of the psychology department, the first thing you would see was a sign reading, "God is a 6, a variable interval of behavioral reinforcement plucked from the vortex." In this view, freedom, or accidents, shrink as our developing capabilities in measurement and computation provide more information about the vortex of stimuli. Ignorance about human behavior is like a melting iceberg on a warming planet, destined to yield to the mounting heat as we invent the means and methods smart enough to first decipher and then control the vortex of stimuli that shapes each fact of human behavior. Skinner pointed to weather forecasting as the iconic example of this transformation from ignorance to law, just as Meyer had done decades earlier. The problems imposed by the complexity of a subject matter must be dealt with as they arise. Apparently, hopeless cases often become manageable in time. It is only recently that any sort of lawful account of the weather has been possible. Self-determination does not follow from complexity. Difficulty in calculating the orbit of the fly does not prove capriciousness, though it may make it impossible to prove anything else. 6. A technology of human behavior,